This week, the precious metals rally continued for the 9th week in a row, and the Dow Jones Industrials added another 200 en route to 22,000. Welcome back, everyone. Just a pleasure to be with you. Chris Waltzek, we have yet again two more big guests for you. Bob Hoy returns to the show. We discussed John Ng's comments. He recently presented his findings to China, suggesting that gold should double from these levels, run to $2,200 an ounce. We outline why he's so bullish on gold. And for our sci-fi fans, we get into a somewhat intriguing discussion about the current developments in IBM's DeepMind AI and their AlphaGo and the implications of general purpose artificial intelligence. Then Andy Schechtman from Miles Franklin Institute returns to the show. He outlines why every investor should diversify their precious metals holdings with an offshore account. And we'd like for you to call into our toll-free hotline. That's 641-715-3900. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Gold finished at the highest close of the year and the best in over 3 months, adding about $12, up 1%, closing at $12.51, while silver picked up 40 cents, 2%, ending at $18.41 an ounce. The precious metals XAU shares ended at 88.62, off 4%, bucking the trend down 4%, but black gold added 67 cents, up 1.3%, finishing at $54.50, and the chart just red hot. I'm looking for a move to 70 in short order in the coming weeks and months, and maybe even the triple digits within the next 12 to 24 months. In related news, the price of gold climbed over $12.50 an ounce for the first time in over 3 months on Friday. The breakthrough came just a day after the new U.S. Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, discussed his significant reform plans in front of Congress. The current plan is to implement and give these details later in the summer, perhaps as late as August, though. The comments implied higher inflation in the coming years, which helped subdue the U.S. dollar and spur gold and silver. Adding to the appeal of the safe haven, demand rose amid growing concerns that Fed policymakers continue to waver on their comments about raising the benchmark lending rate. Another big positive for the metals. Plus, continued geopolitical uncertainty in the Eurozone. We have upcoming elections in the Netherlands, France, Italy, Greece, Germany, suggesting that the populist uprising, which began with the Grexit, on to the Brexit, and now to the Trumpsit, could spread all throughout the world, in particular the EU, threatening the already shaky status quo. Investors continue to pile into the precious metals in anticipation of further volatility. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly sunny skies persisted over the New York Stock Exchange as investors picked added U.S. equities in anticipation of the proposed tax reform and deregulation plans. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones Industrials picked up 200 points, 2%, finishing at 20,821. The S&P 500 added 16 points, closing at 2367 for the week, while the NASDAQ added 7 points, finishing at 5845. All three major indices were higher by 10% or more since the election, while the S&P is now trading 26 times earnings, though. That's well above the long-term average of around 17. In related news, although most of the Fed's latest meeting minutes suggest that the central bank intends to lift rates fairly soon, policymakers still seem to be a bit in the dark over the minutia of Mnuchin's new tax and regulatory reforms. In fact, he noted this week that it could be, as I mentioned, as late as August before those are released, the details. And, of course, when we take a look here at the Fed funds futures, the current June-July time frame implied by the futures contracts may be a bit ambitious. Policymakers seem to think they have a loose cannon, and they're just not sure how to react at this point. Bottom line on equities. While the technical picture is still bullish for the sector, with the Fear and Greed Index showing no signs of frothiness, which is kind of surprising given the recent ascent. From a contrarian perspective, the number of concerned commentators and pundits is, I think, a very positive sign. This market simply will not stop until that last bear sings. Once the sellers capitulate, then we'll start to look for signs of a top. I continue to watch for Dow 22,000 in the coming weeks. And after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. We'd like for you to stay with us. Today's special guest, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors.
Hey, Chris, good to hear from you.
And you as well. And let's talk about your new homepage at Institutional Advisors. Seems to be a lot of neat information and resources available.
Yeah, we update it from time to time. And the recent one, we did sort of the last a little while here, and just I'm bringing it up myself here. I like the top part where we say, welcome to the rational fringe, and we've always felt that we've been rational because everything we do is based upon the original deep research into financial history. And I, first of all, when started working on that, I was reading some economists. And then I soon realized that, hey, that was the history of ideas. You really wanted was the history of the financial markets, which, well, originally you got, eventually were able to get price histories on bonds and interest rates going way back. And then you had got consumer price indexes going way back, and journals written by guys who were in the financial markets at the time, either in New York or going back further in London. And then all the history went together. So I guess my major contribution to the economic literature was to discover that when you would have periods, say 15, 20 years of dynamic economic growth, and of course we're talking about being in the senior economy in all cases. So you'd have a long period of dynamic economic growth that would finish off with a rampant burst of commodity speculation and soaring CPI inflation and wages going up and all that sort of stuff. And then that would reach a climax. That would set up a period of speculation in financial assets. So this is where actually I started going to financial institutions in 1981, and with a overhead slide projector and that sort of stuff. And now also to go back to 1979, 80, 81 is when the truth first started coming out about inflation. Prior to that, the establishment was going on that, oh, inflation was wage push or cost pull or something like that, and had nothing to do with reckless central banking. And Friedman came out and said that inflation is forever and ever always a financial thing with central banks. So the fund manager would then begin to shift over and realize that, hey, inflation seriousness is here to stay. And I came along and pointed out that no matter how much the Fed prints, financial assets would outperform commodity prices. Well, in 1981 and 82, this was highly controversial because they had all shifted their portfolios over to inflation forever. That meant getting out of bonds at 15% yield. The stock market had been terrible, so it was a rough time for fund managers. And then in mid-1982, of course, the markets turned around and exploded. And history is incorrect when they suggest that Paul Volcker personally ended inflation in 1981, because if you look at the Fed data, there was no the expansion of M2, for example, was relentless. And it didn't change. But what you did have was a crash in commodities like 1921. And what followed 1921? Well, a great big financial party. So that was the transition from inflation and tangible assets to inflation and financial assets. And the inflation and financial assets has continued with, of course, some bull and bear markets in between. But the regime of inflation in financial assets is still very much on, and it has now the biggest bubble in history has been accomplished in the bond markets. The long-dated treasuries blew out in July last year, and it gave all kinds of technical signals, you know, it was upside exhaustions and sequential sell, and we had everything on that. Long treasuries have indeed come down in price quite a bit. And on that one in July, we noted that where the treasury market could correct, the low-grade market, junk bonds, could continue. And indeed, the junk bonds have continued to recent weeks, and we've got the same signals, upside exhaustions and sequential cell on junk bonds. So key thing on here is that the research I was doing called for a great bull market in bonds. The work we did last summer said that it's over. This is quite probable, and now that you've got having accomplished the same technicals, once you get that sector going down, then it'll get attention. And the reason for bond prices going down and interest rates going up would not be a big bulge of inflation coming along in tangible assets, you know, CPI and stuff like that. It would be due to an age-old problem of too much debt, not enough economy, and an inability to service the debt. So this would be the killer. We're looking for a great bond revulsion whereby everybody says, I'm not going to own bonds. And that seems hard to imagine now, but it could go on. But anyways, back to the revisions and the new home page on our website is that we put in some of the calls we made, like in 2000 when the great dot-com bubble was on, and using our work, we had the count on the yield curve, and a few other things. And so, in January that year, we counted out that probably the peak in speculation would be around March, and virtually every issue going out to March, we counted that out, and then said, "Well, here, this is it." And then our technical stuff was showing well just how incredibly dynamic it was. And March turned out to be actually the high for the whole of that bubble, and then the collapse. And then we use our bottoming stuff, which then we had the model that calls for the tops of speculation are called upside exhaustions. And that same model is designed to give important bottoms, and we call that a downside capitulation. And the importance of having the bottoming technical side is that there's often a tendency for people to think, oh, stocks are really cheap, they're really down, and I'll buy some, and trying to catch a falling knife, which can be painful. So the downside capitulation is intended to or defer or prevent trying to catch falling knives and trying to get the bottom, and it's been reliable. And then the other big call, which we're very pleased with, was in 2007. On that party, which, of course, every speculation as it peaks, the telltale will be changes in the credit markets either right at or somewhat before. So in that one, again, our count of 16 to 18 months on an inverted curve counted out to May. So we were looking for the yield curve to reverse at around May of 2007, and it did. And then we also expected that then credit spreads would begin to widen at about or soon after, and it did. And when it was about June the 8th, 2007, I was at a financial thing in London, and one of the slides was on the PowerPoint was an image of a very severe train wreck, and the comment was that the greatest train wreck in the history of credit was about to start. And indeed, it did turn out to be, because even the establishment later on did say that that was the worst calamity since the 1930s. So those are a couple of examples of calls. And then we've had some unsolicited remarks come in, and I'm rather pleased with them. Did a piece on central planning and big governments, that it was kaput. And a portfolio manager writes in, "Your treatise is simply outstanding," which is kind of nice. Then Bob Moriarty at 321 Gold pointed out that Institutional Advisors is one of the finest and most accurate subscription services on the web. Jim Grant at Grant's Interest Rate Advisor says, "I thank you for this fine work on the bond market." So, yeah, it's a good record. I sort of enjoy looking back on it. And, of course, Chris, you always know that each one of these major turns in the financial markets, either at a top or at a bottom, is very, very difficult to make the call against the tide. And this is where one can do it, and many traders do it intuitively, but we like to do it with a lot of research backing up. And so this is where the historical has been a good guide. And then also my colleague Ross Clark with his technical work, which has been outstanding. And everything on the technical side is tested, to back tested and forward tested and everything else, until we ended up with the two tools that work. One is our upside exhaustions for the tops, and the other is what we call the sequential sells, which is patterned. I should emphasize that the upside exhaustions and downside capitulations, they relate to momentum and time, and then the sequentials, they're a certain pattern. So you've got momentum on one indicator and pattern on the other. And that's the basics of our business. Been providing research. I call it dealing in the foreseeable future since 1981.
Kudos for those comments. Of course, Bob Moriarty, just the best and top money managers. Like to go off on a bit of a tangent, off topic here today. One of our favorite shows here, Humans, is a UK or British science fiction, or some folks will call it fantasy. I call this sci-fi. In fact, I'd call this sci-fact, about AI and robots, where they are indistinguishable from typical human beings. There's a new season. They're calling it, I think, Humans 2.0. There's been some remarkable developments in artificial intelligence. Isaac Asimov, and of course my favorite, Arthur C. Clarke, Philip K. Dick, the creator of every fascinating science fiction that's really made it in the last 20, 30 years, from obviously Blade Runner, Minority Report, Total Recall. Okay, completely unscripted. Alexa, weather.
Currently, in Sapphire, it's 53 degrees with cloudy skies. Today, you can expect showers, with a high of 58 degrees and a low of 45 degrees.
Thank you.
Sure. Nice chatting with you.
You as well. Okay, so here's just a little idea, a $40 device my wife gave to my son over the holidays from Amazon. Plugs into your computer and into the internet, and once it's all set up, you can order items from Amazon. You can ask anything from the weather to the atomic weight of uranium, of gold, of silver, anything you can think of on Wikipedia, every song that's almost ever been created, any music. You'd like to listen to some Vivaldi, some Chopin, Tchaikovsky, Bach, Handel, Beethoven, Brahms, you name it, Mozart. Instantaneously, my three-year-old already asking it to play his favorite Gummy Bears song. For decades, we've been hearing about how this would happen and there would be this AI revolution that would transform the world. But this is something that was just brought to my attention in the last few hours. IBM's DeepMind just defeated the world's Go Grandmaster. I don't know how many Go players we have and chess players, but I cut my teeth on chess. We have a big passion for chess and Go in my family. I learned Go a few years ago, and let me just say, it is infinitely more complex than chess. Well, they thought it would be at least 10 years before artificial intelligence. Nope, the Grandmaster was wiped off the board. What they did with DeepMind is they said, look, we're not going to build a model. Just as, you know, we're building models for our forecasts and prognostications all day long, multivariate models, regression models. No, they said, no, we're basically going to use a genetic algorithm, which is we're going to run a bunch of, you know, martingale hypothetical situations and let it, over 30 million games, start to improve on itself. In other words, we're not going to teach it. We're going to let it learn by trial and error. And I would argue most of the great accomplishments of this world, you might agree with this, Edison comes to mind. I bet that you'd find that Steve Jobs and Wozniak would probably agree with that. They're calling it a general purpose AI. It is applicable throughout the world. This is not just a Go AI. Anything we put it to, it just runs through the iterations. And by the time you wake up in the morning, it's Albert Einstein, Ramanujan. What we've had up until this point, Bob and our listeners, is we've had a pocket calculator. We all remember them. My gosh, they were $200. I'll never forget, I was about 9 years old when I first saw one in the store. It was just less than $200 at Eckerd's drugstore. The current AIs that everyone has except for DeepMind is a calculator. There's not a huge leap between a calculator and a computer, a general purpose computer. And we've seen what that's ushered in around the world. So there although they're identical almost mechanically. Well, I believe that's what we've just stumbled onto here. I believe we have not crossed the singularity that we refer to in artificial intelligence, but we are on the cusp. We are literally knocking at the door. We are about to cross the event horizon of the singularity, because I think that this is the most significant advance animal in intellectual evolution. We'd all love to have, you know, a team of the world's best traders working for us around the clock on the markets, right? Following maybe the euro dollar and perhaps the yen and what, and all these different markets, gold and silver, and trading on our behalf. Just the best minds in the world. I've run many hundreds of robots, won a few competitions, and I have a 3-year track record. Comes out to 89% win rate. If you had this deep mind general program working for you, it would run every bit of data on every time frame from tick by tick, minute, 5 minute, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 60, on and on and up, you know, daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, all the different iterations of all the scenarios that have ever come to pass to outperform any single trader by comparison.
As for artificial intelligence, for decades I've been saying is that you have that at the Federal Reserve. You take an ordinary PhD in economics, put him as chairman of the Fed, and instantly they're a genius. One of the things that you got me going on with artificial intelligence is that, going way back, various people I know took the macroeconomic models, econometric modeling, and hired this is in the 70s, hired the Wharton's business school model. And these were two geophysicists running the computers at this big mining company, and they were trying to figure out the business cycle. So anyways, they got all the top model and ran the data through it for the 1920s. And it could not forecast the change you got in 1929. So they said, oh, well, maybe we'll improve it with some geophysics models and stuff. We're doing some advanced mathematics. So they tried to improve the Wharton Business School's econometric model. They did a little, and they ran the numbers again. It still wouldn't get it. Now then, the reason why this econometric model cannot get dynamic changes ahead of time is because if you take a price series such as, the S&P, or commodities, it's anything that goes into a speculative surge. The final part of that surge is a skewed growth curve. And back in the day then, I think we looked around and couldn't find a proof that you could not solve skewed growth curves. But the conclusion was that you cannot solve skewed growth curves. And so this will be interesting to see if artificial intelligence can break that one. I'm doubtful. Then what you do then, by where this is where the history comes in, Chris, is that we look back. Oh, I remember the excitement of plotting down by hand. I'd been to the library, went through all the references on the South Sea Company, and wrote out the prices. And you could get them almost day to day, or certainly week to week, back in 1720. And you had this fabulous growth curve and skewed and went straight up and then crashed. Then plotting in the chart for Radio Corp of America, RCA, which was the really big deal in 1929. Hey, it's a similar chart. Then you move on further and you take a look at what was going on in the dot-com bubble that blew out in March 2000, put in, I don't know, Cisco, any one of those, and they're all the same. So you have a chart pattern that no mathematical equation can solve as it's going on, but then we called it the analog model because you just overlaid one on the other, and it was helpful in sort of calling it top, and then later on, we threw in, Ross worked out his upside exhaustion programs. And then later on, from another researcher, excellent technician, we came up with and have been using his work on the sequential sell. So this is where I say that you have a terrific price history going way back to the 1700s. You use the history, and then For example, if you've got, or if we've got a target for a price series to rally up, like go back to crude oil in 2008 when it rallied up to 147. Well, you have a seasonal where you might get a high for crude around May, and then we then put on the upside exhaustion model on it, and that was in July, and we're getting a weekly upside exhaustion signal. So as I wrote it out, the weekly signal suggests that it would be a cyclical bear market would follow once the explosion was over. And then also noted that if the monthly comes in, then we would call for a secular bear market. Well, the monthly came in, and it went from $147 down to $35. That's how you can use the historical plus getting current dynamics with really top-flight technical research. As a matter of fact, one of the guys who, a letter writer, I'll leave his name out. He's a good guy, good friend, and he said that Ross Clark is the Mozart of technicians. So it's recognized, by professional technicians in the street that my colleague here is doing some outstanding work, and I see his work, and we've worked together for a long time now, 30-plus years. It's been a good partnership, and we're enjoying it, and there's always work to do. There's always new techniques to try, and the whole business is let's make it work as far as the research goes.
Extra kudos for that look back on your work. And, of course, anyone who has invested in the markets in any serious way knows that technical analysis is really the key. I mean, it has been for over 100 years since Livermore. I do want to wrap up the thought on the AI here before we move on, because I do have some important topicality that I'd like to bring up here with this thought. What if the powers that be, or some lone hacker somewhere, I mean, there are plenty of them now, there's a billion people have access to the internet at least. What if AI, okay, a sentient AI, or at least semi-cognizant AI, has already emerged, and nevertheless, it's wise enough, maybe like a cuttlefish, or an octopus, or something along these lines, or a giant squid, to recognize, well, I might be the biggest octopus or giant squid in this area, but, you know, I still have some threats, some risks. They could always turn the power off. I need to accumulate more information, more wealth, bitcoins, if you will, things of that nature. What I'd like to pose here today, there are some huge game-changing events that have just occurred. I believe that we'll look back on the cryptocurrencies, for example, and we will find a game-changing moment that very few people, even today, 5, 6, 7 years later, recognize, even authorities recognize as a game changer. And eventually it will enact its own form of Gresham's Law that will continue to push out all the fiat money in exchange for crypto, digital money. And I think that's going to be another component of this story. Just what will it mean for human beings to have ant-like intelligence? Even the sharpest of our, you know, species to be little more than an ant, an army ant, a soldier ant on the ground compared to these super intelligences that are emerging. Eventually, they will start to accelerate their IQ at an exponential pace. We're already seeing that in technology. Here's a perfect example. The first billion years of this world of life involved the creation of DNA to form from a molecular structure into the DNA we now are based on today. It took about 100 million years for our current plant and animal life to emerge. Think of how much more quickly that occurred. It was a factor of tenfold. Thank you for indulging me, Bob, and listeners. John Ng, a very well-known money manager. Some folks consider him really the tops in the field currently, in certain parts of the world at least. John Ng was just asked by the government of China to present his overview financially and economically with this new administration in place in the United States. He believes that what we're facing here is a near-perfect world for the metals. At some point, the new administration will go head-to-head, toe-to-toe with the Federal Reserve, which has been talking acting strong and hawkish on inflation, but in reality, it looks as though the dollar could be doomed because the new administration has so many big plans, big walls, big ideas in play that will require a massive amount of funding and ultimately could crush the U.S. dollar, sending gold at least to $2,200 an ounce.
The transition that's going on now politically in the U.S. is part of a global movement. We called it, July 4th, I published that piece called American Spring. And it is another great reformation. The last one happened in the early 1600s when, after 100-plus years of an experiment in authoritarian and at times murderous government, the public got fed up with it and found a way to throw it off. I've called it also the popular uprising. And the last popular uprising occurred in the late 1980s when a highly dissatisfied public in Eastern Europe took on murderous police states and shut them down. This then gets to the idea about the U.S. dollar going to go down. And one of the things that has been remarkable is the ability of the state to fund itself beyond confiscatory taxation. They've had the Federal Reserve, which has been corrupted, into providing unlimited funding for yet another experiment in unlimited government. And all of this is coming to an end. And this means an end to the chronic price inflation that's been on for 100-plus years. So I know John Ng well, but on the U.S. dollar, which is still the reserve currency, there's another factor beyond that this is the end of a long experiment in authoritarian government and inflation, on a post-bubble contraction. And the bubble that blew out in 2007 had a lot of the features of the 1929 bubble, and that was confirmed with the crash being the worst since the 1930s. And this, we're on the first business expansion and bull market out of a classic. But the main thing is in each post-bubble period, and there have been five previous ones, this is number six, that the senior currency has become chronically strong, as I like to say, against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time. And the U.S. dollar index, well, I think the low was 73 in 2007 with the bubble top, now around 101. So that thesis is working out. And on a near-term chart, the correction we expected when it got up to 103.85 and came down to the 96 level, it's over, virtually over, and breaking above 102 on the DX would set the next uptrend. And our target then is up towards 110 or 112. You can mix in a whole lot of stuff, but there's a certain contingent out there who are gold-related, and they will look at anything and say that gold's going to go to 2,000 or 10,000 or whatever, and I don't think that type of analysis is going to work. It hasn't really to date. And what does work is the old historical. Now, here's where one can get excited about the gold stocks, because in every post-bubble contraction, the real price of gold has gone up. It's gone up significantly and makes the gold mining industry very profitable, so it becomes the best game in town. Now, I would sooner be bullish on gold stocks based upon rational historical evidence rather than some taking a look at a current event like Trump and his ambition and say, oh, gold's going to go to 2000.
We have to be a bit cautious with making some of these prognostications based on current economic events, because if we just go back to, let's say, 1982, we had only $900 billion in only. in our national debt. Fast forward to today, it's more than 20-fold that amount, and we were an economic powerhouse then. Now we're an economic powerhouse in decline. You know, there's a raging forest fire in all directions, and everyone has converged to the, you know, the mansion in the center. I think we are on the verge of something very unprecedented in the markets, and I think we'll see signs of that as the U.S. Stock market, the equities, roll over inevitably. Now, how long will that take? Do we have another 6, 12 months, maybe even longer? After a two-year consolidation, I'm sure you'd agree. What happens ultimately when that party's over, just as we've seen in the bond market?
As a matter of fact, we've got some technical excesses now in the senior stock indexes, and we're expecting a correction like right now. Until it comes in, and the nature of it, we can't tell whether the top, the big top, is in. But on the stock market, we're looking for a rounding top where not every index peaks at the same time. It can take a little while to roll over. But this, our last call for a rounded top was in 2015, and that worked out. It's very tempting to consider that perhaps this might be the top of the big bull market. But there's not enough evidence yet. And also, as I say, we're looking for the next leg up in the dollar index. This would put precious metals down. The targets we had for base metals on the base metal index, GYX, we reached those. We're looking for about 332 on the index for March, and it got to 339 already. Good enough. So we see that the lumber was hot until a couple of weeks ago, and that generated upside exhaustion signals. So the many commodities could be weak over the next few months as the dollar firms up. But this is one of the mysteries of post-bubble contractions, and as I like to phrase it, Chris, the senior currency becomes chronically strong against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time. We'll stay with that one. And one of the mechanisms for the relentlessly strong senior currency has been that during the financial bubble, with all the debt that's issued, most of it has been written in the financial center, which is New York, due and payable in U.S. dollars in New York, and that then the biggest short position in history of U.S. dollars. And decades ago, generations ago, of course, it was sterling was the senior currency, and it was the same thing. And even if you go back to the mid-1500s, when Gresham was the financial agent of the British Crown in the financial center in Antwerp in Holland, and essentially his letters to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Burleigh, were explaining that, hey, when you owe money into the financial center, you don't want to be paying it back from a weak domestic currency. It's the same old thing. So here you have, when the party was on, countries and corporations all around the world got cheap, cheap money. And they've borrowed more money than they can possibly service. And this has been what prompts the senior currency being strong. Now, it doesn't mean that the gold and the mining business is going to go out. All you have to have is that the cost of mining falls relative to the bullion price. And that's been the case in every post-bubble deflation, where the gold industry becomes very profitable and becomes the big game in town. So we are very bullish on the long term for the gold sector, but not because gold's going to go to $2,000, but because the real price of gold will continue up, and it will enhance the profitability of mining gold.
What I'm watching and waiting for is the ultimate peak in equities, which I agree with you. I prefer to identify the peak after the fact. It'll sound odd to some folks. Yeah, look at 2007, 2008. We had a perfect, as you refer to, rounding top. That's how most market peaks are identified. Once that occurs, I mean, I don't think bonds will suddenly reestablish themselves as the go-to market. If equities lose favor, well, housing almost inevitably follows equities. There's almost a one-to-one correlation there. All of the go-to risk-on places and even pseudo-safe havens become less desirable. I think that represents at least a solid opportunity for the precious metals. Well, Bob Hoy, just great stuff today.
I always enjoy working with you, and you can find us at institutionaladvisors.com, or I've discovered even you just put in my name, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, it comes up, and you get into our website, and there's some good stories in there. Okay, Chris, next time.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Andy Schickman, president of Miles Franklin Limited. This is going to be a must-hear interview for so many of our listeners. How's the weather today way up there, way up north, Andy?
Hey, Chris, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me. Today and tomorrow, ridiculously cold, and then spring seems to make an early appearance come Friday. It's supposed to be all the way up almost to 50 degrees over the weekend. So, you know, once we get within eyeshot of March, you'll start to see windows opening and jackets shedding, and, you know, we're hardy up here in Minnesota.
That's great to hear. Well, I know we're all anxious to, to see the foliage unfold here as well in the mountains, and cabin fever is what we get here. All right, transition here into confiscation. There's a lot of rumors. You know, back in the day, I want to say the 30s, there was an edict to turn in the gold. We need it for national security purposes. And as we were talking also before the show, there's a lot of misunderstanding, misconceptions about this time because nobody turned in the gold that didn't want to. There, you didn't have to. Very few ounces were even confiscated from bank security boxes, but they frightened the herd, if you will, into turning in their gold. Nevertheless, it still looms like the sword of Damocles. Give us your take on confiscation, please.
I think it was Executive Order 6102. It was the first thing President Roosevelt did in late March or early April in 1933. He confiscated gold. And the reason, when you say the fear, well, the fear, the executive order actually said penalty being $10,000 fine or 10 years imprisonment or both for not turning it in. And the reason that people would have turned it in back then would have been that differentiating from today is that Back then, everyone owned gold. Gold was money prior to 1933. Most people had gold in their possession. However, by this time, a lot of people were using the notes, the $20 gold certificates, the $10 gold certificates, because it was easier to hold than was the actual gold coin themselves. So many of the gold coins that were confiscated were held by the banks. I would suspect that you're probably right. A lot of the people who actually held the gold coins in their possession didn't turn them in, hid them. And of course, the elite knew of this coming long before the people did and shifted much of what they had out of the country into Europe. But if we look at confiscation today, I've been saying for a very long time that I don't believe we will see gold confiscation in this country. A lot of the companies in my industry that you see talking about gold confiscation have an ulterior motive. Their objective is to get people to buy high-grade numismatics. Now, I like numismatic coins. I think owning old $20 gold pieces is a kick. I mean, it's great. It's a story. It's history. It's not just gold. It's Americana. It's very cool, but it's not the ideal situation for preservation of capital. It's more like the cherry on top of the sundae. What I really believe, Chris, and maybe I'm wrong in this, but it's something I have believed for a very long time. I think the government knows that in the land of supposedly, the land of the free, the center of free trade, the world reserve currency, if we were to activate eminent domain, as Roosevelt did in 1933, and confiscate gold when countries like communist China and the rest of the world is accumulating gold, it would be the death sentence for the dollar. And so I think that they've come up with a solution that's ingenious. What they did was they came up with two funds that will attract all the big hedge fund money, attract all the financial advisory money, attract all of the stock market money, that being GLD and SLV. GLD is the fourth or fifth largest stockpile of gold in the world, and SLV, the first or second largest stockpile of silver in the world. Actual physical silver held by by J.P. Morgan, and actual physical gold held by HSBC in their role as a custodian. So on a Friday night, government comes in when confiscation is floating through the air and decides, you know what, let's take all the gold held by GLD and all the silver held by SLV. We'll close those two funds on a Friday night. All the money that people have in those accounts, we will give them the whatever the share close was on Friday night, it'll be in their money market Monday morning. So then they can, on Monday morning, shrug their shoulders, look at the world and say, what did we do? We didn't activate eminent domain. We didn't nationalize assets of our citizenry. All we really did was close two funds, which the prospectus gives us the ability to do. We have remunerated everyone to whatever their account value was at the close of a business on Friday. You can still go buy physical gold and silver through the U.S. Eagle program or through any distributor in the United States like Miles Franklin. It gives them the ability to have their cake and eat it too, in a very stealth way. Because really, the truth of it, Chris, is I'll be 47 this summer. I've been doing this since I was 19 years old. Miles Franklin just celebrated our 28th year in business this month, and I can count on maybe one and a half hands how many people my age here in the Twin Cities have approached me about precious metals. And the thing of it is that most people in this country wouldn't know a gold coin if it fell on their foot. It's a very different time than it was in the 30s when everyone owned gold. It was part of the monetary system. So now I think it would create far too much turmoil that the government for to come in and create, maybe even violate civil liberties, break some laws in order to take people's gold, it would create far too much backlash when it's owned by such a tiny minority of the public. Instead, they have two giant funds that they can just come and really pickpocket and not violate civil liberties and not infringe any laws. And I think it would be a whole lot better choice for them, certainly, than a confiscating gold, which I really don't think will happen.
And I'd like to underscore just again here a couple of key takeaway points you've outlined. This idea of the ETF, it's a fata morgana, because what investors don't realize is only the ones at the top, only with folks with $1 million or more invested in StreetTrack's GLD ETF gold exchange traded fund, only those folks can redeem any of the gold. And there's really some question as to whether or not they even will have a chance to redeem the gold, and how much is on hand, and how much is double counted, and how much is hypothecated vis-a-vis the futures market. We have been suggesting as an alternative the Canadian fund, CEF, which has silver and gold, so it's distributed between the two. But again, you know, you always have that third party risk. And do you really want that risk? Why should we take on that risk? And is it necessary? We want people to wrap their minds around the idea. Sure, you can have that numismatic. We mirror your thoughts exactly with numismatics. We, you know, love them, grew up with them. In the final analysis, it's like owning fine art. You know, you can enjoy it, but that's typically, as you say, the cherry on the top, the icing. We want to crystallize our wealth and our savings for our families. The key topic is moving your precious metals offshore. And this is where I think Miles Franklin has really come up with a fantastic service to give folks an idea of, you know, some of the interesting developments in this area and just what you're doing for clients today.
Absolutely, Chris. Thank you. Well, we've had a relationship with Brinks Canada now for going on 7 years. We developed a program originally in Montreal that we thought at the time was very cutting edge, and we're still very proud of it in the respect that it's unique. It's unique in the respect that we charge people their storage rate based upon the number of ounces that they hold rather than the value that it has. In other words, typically the way that people are charged for storage is a percentage of the item's asset value. And the reason that is the across the board method of paying for storage is that the number one biggest cost in running a storage facility is the insurance. And as what you're insuring or storing goes up in value, so too would the cost of your insurance. We negotiated a deal with Brinks, and as far as I know, in North America, there really aren't any other deals like this whereby we have a fixed rate structure so that we charge you based upon the number of ounces that you hold rather than the value that it has. And the higher the price goes, the higher your storage rate would go with everyone else. With us, it stays fixed. It's something that very well received about 6 or 7 years ago when we started and has grown into a very large storage program in Montreal. But along the way, we had discussions with the IRS and discussions with other investors, and it went something like this. The IRS has very strict rules for reporting things that are outside the United States. And as it pertains to precious metals, they have always said, and by the way, when I say the IRS, let's also mention in this same discussion the Treasury Department, because the Treasury Department wants us to fill out the FBAR form if we have stuff outside the country, and the IRS wants us to fill out the FACTA form. They're both largely redundant, almost identical in what they're asking, but they must not share the information because you have to fill out both. So somewhere along the line, about 5-6 years ago, the IRS came out with clarification on as it relates to both programs. Now, prior to that, we kept asking the IRS what their definition of directly held was, because from the get-go, they said that metal held outside the United States, in order for it to be compliant and not reportable, two things must be present. Number one, it must be housed in a non-financial institution. And number two, it must be directly held. Now, what we did is we asked the IRS what's directly held, and we asked them through three separate attorneys anonymously. And the attorney would call the IRS or write a letter to the IRS and say, our client wants to know what is directly held. And for over a year, and to the tune of many thousands of dollars in attorney's fees, they basically came back and said, we reserve the right to not tell you what directly held means. We're still kind of trying to figure it out. So we have always interpreted, Chris, directly held as segregated, okay? And our accounts in Montreal are indeed 100% segregated. They're audited twice per year, including third-party auditing by a company called Inspectorate. We've always felt that our account was compliant. But along the way, there were some people who still question, is directly held segregated? There's a newsletter writer named Mark Nessman, very, very smart man, who you may know, and Mark is a privacy taxation expert. And Mark's take on it was that directly held means something different. Now, the IRS, about 5 years ago, came out with this FBAR FACTA clarification. And what they said was, very succinctly, that metals held outside the United States, in order for them to not be reportable, must be directly held in a non-financial institution, example, safe deposit box. Now, until November of this year, that did not exist, really. It may have existed somewhat in Austria with Das Safe. But in that situation, you actually need to fly to Austria to do the to do your transactions. We developed a program in conjunction with Brinks and launched it in November of last year, and have a worldwide exclusive with Brinks because we developed the program. And it is the first of its kind, fully insured safe deposit box system in Toronto Brinks and in Vancouver Brinks. And the deal is that they're state-of-the-art, brand-new, one-key safe deposit boxes. They're not the two keys like you're normally associated with in a bank where the bank holds the master key and you hold the other key. This is a one-key box, brand-new. You hold the one key, you hold the spare. The way that it works is going to send metal up to Vancouver or Toronto. We arrange it. It gets sent up there. When it gets received, you get the key, the spare, a laminated certificate, and a plastic ring tag, the other half of which will be around the box the next time you go up there. If you're not able to get back up there to your box, you would let us know. We would furnish an air bill for you. You would drop the key in the air bill, send it up by UPS directly to Brinks. They would transact the business for you and send you back a new certificate, send your key back, and a new ring that will be around the other half, which will be around the box when you go back up there, if you do. The bottom line is, it is the same type of insurance, fully insured, by the ounce, not by the value, but now, following the law to the letter, it is 100% FACTA FBAR compliant as per the IRS and the Treasury Department. There is no reporting. It is invisible. And there's one little cool twist to this box that we have that is somewhat unique, and that is, if any of your listeners happen to have a Canadian bank account, we are able to have Brinks pick up cash as much as they want, $1 million in $100 bills, $2 million, $5 million, and have it held in the safe deposit box, fully insured. Now, Brinks would have to pick that up from the bank and deposit it into the box. Once that is done, the client can go up to the box and access the cash any way they want, but it is fully, fully, fully insured. And when you look at the insurance in Canada, similar to FDIC, I believe it's only $100,000. So it's a neat program, one that we're very excited about, one that we have been granted exclusivity to. And, you know, if you're looking to get money out of the country to, in my opinion, Chris, the biggest reason to get it out is less confiscation and more the prospect of currency controls like we're seeing. And if that happens very quickly, they'll shut the door and, you know, when people are scurrying to get out of dollars, it's not like people are just going to buy Swiss francs or buy Canadian dollars to protect themselves. First, they're selling dollars, which exacerbates the inflation and increases the velocity. The first thing the government will do if things get bad is close the opportunity to get money out of the country. And I think that's why proactively you put money in a place like the Canadian safe deposit box, fully insured. You hold the only key and invisible, according to the law of the letter. And you don't have to look over your shoulder and think to yourself, you know, is the IRS going to be knocking on my door and wondering where all my money went? Quite to the contrary, we have dotted the I's and crossed the T's on this.
Once you've taken this leap, this is your savings, it's maybe your retirement, and you've sent it offshore, you want to know that there's still contact, that Miles Franklin doesn't just disappear. Well, look, they hold your hand the whole time, sends you monthly inventory of what they're holding on your behalf. Whether or not you stay in touch or not, they stay in touch with you. incredibly reasonable monthly fees. Of course, then you have a key type of diversification that none of your financial planners are going to share with you. When they finally drop the hammer, there's just not going to be time for the typical saver and investor to move. Let's say you've got $20,000, $50,000 in cash in a checking or savings account, local branch, okay, or even a big national money center bank. I challenge you to go down to the branch today and pull out more than $10,000 or $20,000. Won't they tell you, come back in 3 days, come back in 5 days, even if it's less than $10,000, anything out of the ordinary, and they send off a form. This is the kind of thing that people are going to face. What happens when it's not just you asking for $10,000 or $20,000? It's your neighbors. It's their neighbors. In this digital world, there just isn't going to be time to react. So you have that peace of mind. You know, send a few coins, send a few bars, but start today.
What I would like to bring up, the last point I'd like to bring up, Chris, first of all, thank you very much for having me on. Just as a side note, Peter Spina, who runs GoldSeek and SilverSeek, has been a dear friend of mine for a long time, someone I respect a lot and love what you're doing and appreciate the ability to be here. As it pertains to my company, the biggest reason to work with us, first of all, two reasons. One, we publish a free daily newsletter, milesfranklin.com. Andy Hoffman does an amazing job of a tireless job of talking economics and big picture and world events, and it's free. I really think people would like it. Check it out. Go to our website, milesfranklin.com, under the Contact Us section. Sign up for the newsletter. The second reason, and this is the reason that anyone who buys gold must pay attention to, give me 60 seconds, it's worth your time. In the last 3 years, the three biggest precious metals companies in the United States, online companies, have gone bankrupt and stolen a combined $130 million in client money. 2014, it was Tulving. $600 million a year in sales disappeared with north of $50 million in client money. He's in prison. 2015, Bullion Direct, $35 million stolen. He's in prison. Last year, 2016, Northwest Territorial Mint, one of the biggest companies in the country, had been running an 8-year Ponzi scheme. I read that on GoldSeek. He's in prison. The point of it is that this is an industry that is federally non-regulated, with the exception of the state of Minnesota, my home state. As of 2 years ago July, because of all of this corruption, the state of Minnesota said our citizens are not going to be harmed any longer, and they have imposed the first and only regulated state in America as far as precious metals are concerned. As a result, we are beholden to the Commissioner of Commerce with a $200 million surety bond, background checks of every one of our employees annually, and principals. And if anyone has a felony related in any capacity to financial services, we are ineligible for being in the industry, and compliance regulations that no one else has to abide by. And as a result, nearly 100% of the precious metals companies throughout the United States have boycotted Minnesota. They will not sell products into my state, because whether you live where you do, Chris, and own a small precious metals company, and you just happen to sell one coin to someone here in Minnesota, or like me here in Minnesota doing $280 million a year in business, whether you are in either situation, you have to be licensed and bonded and background checked by the state. So as a result, everyone just about in this industry has said, you know what, nuts to Minnesota, we'll do business anywhere else. What that means is simply this. You can't get ripped off by buying gold from a company in Minnesota, because they are background checked, licensed, and bonded, the most important thing. On top of that, we've done north of $6 billion in sales and never had one customer complaint, ever. I implore your listeners to try to find one online. We have as good of a reputation as you'll ever find, and the state of Minnesota guarantees that. So just a little food for thought when you're looking online and thinking that the company who sells a Silver Eagle for 15 cents less than another company is the best choice. I think there's a whole lot more to this industry, in a federally non-regulated industry, than price. Reputation is everything. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Again, I really appreciate the chance to be on, and happy to come back anytime.
No, we'll have to have you back on soon. Of course, Andy Hoffman as well. We'd love for our listeners just to reach out to Peter Spina, peter@goldseek.com or ps@goldseek.com, and let him know that you appreciate the show.
Chris, thanks again. Anytime.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Free markets are the underpinning of economic freedom. For a long, long time, since at least the 1960s, when, for example, healthcare began to be infiltrated with government mandate and involvement, we began down the slippery slope of the mixed economy. Part capitalism, part feel-good socialism, sold to us via the concept of incrementalism, one small piece at a time. Easier to swallow because far too many were afraid to be labeled insensitive, uncaring, or worse. Not that they were, it's just that they never prepared a moral or proper argument to counter such labels. It was just easier to go along. And after just going along for too long, one eventually crosses the point of no return. We've crossed those different junctures of no return at various points in our recent history, on subjects that underscore the fabric of our nation and our freedom. The real chink in the armor, in my opinion, began with the mainstream media and their willful actions to deny and disown the many unanswered questions of 9/11. I personally stopped watching much of mainstream media in the year or two following 9/11, because it became clear that their bias was uniform and in sync. It was 9/11 that incubated and spawned the rise of the alternative media, and it was the alternative media that researched and answered many questions of 9/11 and countless other topics since that time. I recall in 2005 or 2006, a high school age son of one of our friends explaining to me in great detail what happened to the Twin Towers and how the year before his eighth grade science class had discussed this in detail. Quite to the contrary of what was being discussed as the resolute authority on the matter in the mainstream media. Mainstream media has not kept up on that, or very many other subjects, including the 2016 presidential election. They have failed to grasp the power of direct, one-to-one, peer-to-peer communication that completely bypasses them and their concentration of a half-dozen corporations that control them. Remember the 2008 economic collapse that no one in the mainstream media saw coming, and how they ridiculed anyone who had clarity of vision to articulate its arrival. As soon as the collapse occurred, all those who failed to see it wanted to proclaim they immediately had the answer to the problem they denied had ever existed. What kind of credibility is that? This week we heard Mika Brzezinski on Morning Joe say, as she was discussing Donald Trump, he could have undermined the messaging so much, he can actually control exactly what people think. And that is our job, she said. No, Mika, it's not your job or Joe's or anyone's in the media to control what any of us think. Your job is to report, and if possible, provide some expertise or background on the subject, if possible. The mainstream media, which includes giants like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Apple, have been caught tampering across the digital spectrum to censor independent, direct media sources this week. Freedom of speech is nothing to mess with, because without it, there are no free markets. There can be no free society or freedom. If continued, these are dangerous actions for the future viability of these organizations, because the eighth graders of today, who in most cases are more tech-savvy than most of the operatives in these corporations, will change society once again over the next decade, just as it has been changed this past decade, in a stealth, hidden manner that gets sprung on those who are not paying attention all at once, and without warning. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.